Today's critique focuses on Dr. Bichara Sahali's manuscript, Circulatory Health as a Coherence System, which, you know, reframes cardiovascular health from a model of downstream disease management into this really multi-scale system integrating biological, social, economic, and planetary determinants. But viewing this really ambitious work through the lens of completeness and focus, we have to immediately address how these massive conceptual frameworks can actually be translated into practical, measurable applications for the people running our health systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the conceptual mapping of economic and governance factors to physiological load is brilliant, but the framework currently lacks a specific mechanism for measuring the distortion field that identifies.
Right.
So when we dig into Figure 2, the manuscript introduces this this really compelling idea of a commercial and governance distortion field.
Yeah, love that term.
It's great, right? The core argument here is that our perceived system state diverges from our actual biological system state. Essentially, the commercial environment normalizes health risks and delays our adaptive responses even as our actual physiological load rises and, you know, our physical capacity declines.
Exactly.
The weakness, however, is that this remains an entirely theoretical construct in the text. I mean, there was no proposed metric, proxy, or early warning signal to help policymakers actually identify or, you know, measure this specific divergence in real time.
Yeah, it's just sort of floating there.
Right. We are told the distortion is happening all around us, but we are not given the instrumentation to detect it.
It feels a bit like, well, to use an analogy, it's like building this incredibly sophisticated dashboard that proves the check engine light on society is fundamentally broken, but then failing to provide the mechanic with a tool to test the bulb.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it.
Right? And so is there a risk that focusing solely on the theoretical existence of this distortion might overlook the practical need for a policymaker to quantify it? Because, you know, if I'm sitting on a city council or in a public health department, I operate on data and budgets.
Yep, hard numbers.
Exactly. If I cannot quantify this distortion field, I can't draft legislation to mitigate it.
That risk is absolutely present, and it threatens to leave the framework in the realm of philosophy rather than actionable policy.
Right.
My suggestion to the author is to firmly anchor the distortion field concept with actionable proxy indicators that can be monitored as part of the proposed early warning signals outlined later in the manuscript.
Okay, yeah.
We really have to give the reader a tangible way to measure the invisible gap between what society perceives and what biology actually endures.
So let's explore what that actually looks like in practice. If the goal is to measure a gap between perception and reality on, you know, a population scale, how do we bulletproof that for a skeptical health minister?
Well, the author could propose specific socioeconomic metrics that reflect this distortion. One way to do this, and this is just one example, would be tracking the statistical gap between a population's self-reported stress levels and the actual local cardiovascular event rates.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So if a population surveys as having relatively low or quote-unquote manageable stress, but local hospital data shows highly elevated rates of stress-induced cardiac events, that statistical gap, that delta, is your distortion field quantified.
Okay, I see what you're saying. But I can definitely see a policymaker pushing back on that, though. I mean, self-reported surveys are notoriously noisy.
True.
People lie, or they simply lack the introspective tools to gauge their own stress, you know? Wouldn't a health minister argue that subjective feelings are just too flimsy to base hard legislation on?
You would think so, but that subjectivity is actually the feature here, not the bug.
Wait, really? How so?
Because the distortion field is, by definition, a subjective illusion created by commercial and governance forces. So when people report that they are fine, despite their arteries telling a very different story, it proves that the commercial environment has successfully normalized their chronic load as just, well, everyday life.
Ah, right. They don't even know they're stressed?
Exactly. The metric isn't the stress itself. The metric is the population's complete inability to perceive the threat.
That's fascinating. Another way to look at this, and perhaps a slightly less subjective metric the author could include, would be to measure the volume of ultra-processed food marketing in a specific zip code against the delay in seeking primary care for metabolic issues in that exact same demographic.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, picture a city planner pulling up a heat map of like fast food billboard density and overlaying it on a map showing late-stage diabetes diagnoses.
Right.
If high marketing density correlates with a delayed clinical presentation, meaning people are waiting much longer to go to the doctor because the commercial environment has normalized their symptoms, you have successfully operationalized the concept of the distortion field.
That is a highly compelling proxy. It gives the policymaker a measurable hard target. By outlining two or three of these specific measurable gaps in the text, the manuscript transitions from merely pointing out a societal flaw to actually handing public health officials the radar equipment needed to track it.
Okay, so we've given the policymaker a metric to measure the systemic distortion. But what happens when that macro-level policy fails and the patient actually shows up sick? I mean, all that systemic failure suddenly falls squarely onto the lap of a single doctor in an exam room.
And that's exactly where we hit our next issue. Transitioning from high-level planetary frameworks down to clinical practice feels slightly disconnected in the current draft, leaving the practitioner without a clear mandate for action.
Yeah, it gets a bit muddy there.
It really does. This weakness becomes highly apparent when we reach Section 24, Implications for Clinical Practice. This section is disproportionately brief compared to the rigorous, multi-layered policy architecture we see in Part 3.
Definitely. It feels kind of tacked on.
Yeah. It places the heavy burden of awareness on the clinician, asking them to understand these massive developmental and commercial determinants without offering a structural way for them to actually act within the coherent system. The manuscript provides an excellent crosswalk table for policymakers, mapping out how different sectors align.
Which is great, yeah.
It's fantastic. But it completely fails to provide a similar operational tool for the doctor facing a patient with diminished physiological capacity.
I actually want to push back gently on the manuscript's premise regarding the prevention gradient we see in Figure 5.
Okay, sure. Let's hear it.
So the paper rightly states that early interventions require less force. We all know that. But the reality of our current medical system is that by the time a patient reaches a tertiary or quaternary care clinic, their capacity is already severely depleting.
Right.
They're already in crisis.
Exactly. The clinical setting is naturally biased toward late-stage, high-force interventions. If I am a doctor with a 15-minute window to see a patient with acute hypertension, I cannot fix their neighborhood's urban planning. You know?
No, you definitely cannot.
So how can the author realistically give clinicians the tools to act on upstream condition design without completely overwhelming their daily practice?
That friction is the fundamental crisis of modern medicine, honestly. And the manuscript needs to address it head on rather than just asking doctors to be, you know, aware.
Right. Awareness doesn't lower blood pressure in a 15-minute consult.
Exactly. My suggestion is to create a localized clinical translation of the policy crosswalk that converts these broad system stability concepts into concrete patient-facing protocols. The clinician cannot fix the city's built environment, but they need a framework that formally acknowledges that environment as a medical variable they can interact with, document, and treat.
What if the author develops something like a clinical coherence checklist?
Ooh, yes. Tell me more.
Right now, a standard intake asks about smoking, drinking, and family history. But those are static data points. A coherence checklist could be designed to formally assess a patient's load versus capacity trajectory over time.
Yeah, making it dynamic.
Exactly. It would give the physician a fast, structured way to document when a patient is transitioning from a healthy adaptive response into maladaptive misalignment long before the ultimate tissue failure actually occurs.
Incorporating a tool like that would completely shift the paradigm of Section 24. Instead of just recording current symptoms, the clinician is actively mapping the patient's system stability.
Right.
Building on that, the text needs a second mechanism regarding systemic integrations for the clinic itself. The manuscript should suggest formally embedding social workers or financial counselors as direct medical interventions to reduce the social determinants load.
Let's trace the biological pathway of that idea because I think it is fascinating.
Let's do it.
Continuous physiological load, then that stress triggers chronic cortisol and adrenaline release.
Yep. Constantly flooding the system.
Which leads directly to endothelial dysfunction, which then leads to plaque rupture. Therefore, a session with a financial counselor is not just a nice community service. It is a direct cardiovascular intervention. It acts almost like a systemic beta blocker.
That is the exact mechanism the author needs to highlight. That's it. By explicitly stating that financial or social counseling acts upon the same circulatory coherence system as a pharmaceutical drug, the manuscript completely shifts the clinician's role.
It elevates it.
Yes. They are no longer a lone healer fighting downstream symptoms with prescriptions. They become a system coordinator actively managing upstream load.
That fundamentally changes the tone of the clinical section. It moves from a philosophical plea for planetary awareness to a highly specific operational mechanism that fits perfectly within the confines of modern time-restricted medicine.
Absolutely.
Now, having established how to operationalize the framework at both the macro policy level and the micro clinical level, we need to examine the structural pacing of the core argument itself, because we haven't yet addressed how the manuscript presents the binary engine driving all of this physiological load.
Right. We need to talk about SDG 8, the reframing of Sustainable Development Goal 8, which focuses on economic growth as a regulator of physiological load, is a standout insight that gets somewhat buried within the broader global alignment discussion.
It really does. It's kind of hidden there.
When we evaluate the structural pacing of Part 3, the tension identified between economic growth and physiological load is arguably the most compelling and original paradox in the entire manuscript.
Without a doubt.
The author points out that work, and the economic engine surrounding it, is the most continuous source of demand in adult life. Prevailing economic models prioritize infinite increased production, which actively drives up finite physiological load.
It is a brilliant observation. I mean, modern hustle culture, the normalization of burnout, the sheer irony of corporate wellness programs that try to, like, meditate away systemic overwork, it all traces back to this demand for endless growth.
It is the root cause, but the weakness is structural. This profound insight currently shares equal weight with the sequential listing of the other SDGs and World Health Organization frameworks.
Yeah, it's just sort of buried in a list.
Exactly. It reads a bit like an encyclopedia entry or a table of contents. SDG 1, then SDG 2, then SDG 3. As a result, the narrative momentum stalls just as the text reaches its most critical policy tension.
Let's look at this from the perspective of the global policymaker reading the manuscript. The central argument is that economic activity can and does undermine health through excessive demand. If I am reading this, I want to see that conflict front and center.
Yes.
Is the connection between this profound economic reframing and the subsequent WHO alignment fully established in the draft, or is that an area to potentially bolster by making it the undisputed centerpiece of Part 3?
Oh, it absolutely needs to be bolstered. The suggestion here is to elevate the SDG 8 reframing from a simple subpoint into a central driving case study that demonstrates exactly how the coherence model resolves real-world policy conflicts.
Okay.
Right now, the concept of work as a physiological load is treated as just one item on a list. Instead, it needs to be the central lens through which the rest of the policy architecture is viewed and validated.
So if we restructure Part 3 to lead immediately with the SDG 8 paradox, the clash between economic growth and physiological capacity, before generalizing to the other goals, it changes the entire reading experience.
Completely.
You introduce the friction first. You start with the uncomfortable truth that infinite economic demand fundamentally breaks finite human biological capacity.
And once that tension is established as the core problem of modern governance, the alignment with WHO frameworks and other SDGs becomes the natural, inevitable solution. It creates a much stronger narrative arc.
It gives it teeth.
Exactly. To ground this structurally, the author could include a brief hypothetical scenario in this section. Map out a factory town or an emerging market where a traditional policy aimed at maximizing economic output, you know, standard SDG 8 execution, causes a predictable, measurable collapse in circulatory capacity among the workforce.
So, like, an industrial boom leads to a spike in chronic stress, poor sleep, and eventually mass cardiovascular events, which completely undermines SDG3, the goal for good health and well-being.
Precisely. The scenario should then contrast this directly with how the new coherence-supporting definition of economic activity would actually prevent that collapse. By running this theoretical simulation right there in the text, you prove the necessity of the framework to the policymaker.
Right.
You show them the mechanical failure of the old system and exactly how the coherence crosswalk fixes it. It moves the theory off the page into a tangible geopolitical reality.
It proves that this framework isn't just an academic exercise, it's a structural blueprint for systemic survival.
Exactly.
To bring our critique of this deeply ambitious manuscript to a close, we have identified three core actionable suggestions to elevate the work. First, to bridge the gap between theory and measurement, the author should develop specific proxy indicators, like tracking the delta between perceived stress and actual cardiac events, to actively measure the commercial and governance distortion field.
Yep, that's step one.
Second, to empower the front line, the manuscript needs a clinical-level tool, like a coherence checklist, to give practitioners a clear mandate to manage upstream load within their time constraints.
Absolutely critical.
And third, to maximize narrative impact, the structural flow of the policy section must be reorganized to elevate the SDG 8 paradox into a central driving case study.
Implementing these conceptual and structural adjustments will take a highly visionary framework and transform it into an operational tool. It will ensure that the people tasked with managing our health, from the city planner all the way to the emergency room physician, actually have the mechanisms they need to intervene.
We invite the author to apply these adjustments to their manuscript and submit the revised work back to the critique for further review. Because ultimately, the goal isn't just to stare at the crack in the concrete of a failing system. The goal is to walk all the way upstream, map the variables, and fundamentally redesign the flow. Keep examining the systems around you, and we will see you next time.